Hello and welcome to Galactic Chat. This is David McDonald and I'm coming to you from Continuum 9 Contraindicators. I'm lucky enough to have Kirsten McDermott with me. Many of you would be familiar with Kirsten. She is the author of books such as Perfections and Madigan Mine, and she's been nominated for or won almost every award possible in Australia. So it's lovely to have you here, Kirsten. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, David.
First, some congratulations are in order for the launch of your new collection.
Yes.
Caution contains small parts.
Yep.
Very exciting.
It is actually. I've been working on that for probably a bit too long. Sorry, Lisa. Yeah, no, that got launched yesterday, and I'm actually really keen to hopefully hear what people think of it, because it does contain the last thing I've written. So I haven't actually written any fiction since I finished that collection, so it's still quite fresh and, yeah, a little bit scary. It's a bit different from what I've previously written, I think, in terms of the style anyway, not so much the content. It's still pretty horrible in terms of the content.
Well, I would
say, in a good way.
Well, these are in the best possible way. It's probably going to scare people more than you have to be scared about their reactions.
Yeah.
I was really interested to read, you've been publishing the notes about each of the stories in the collection.
Yeah, which I don't do a lot of. It's the first time I've ever really written about sort of the backstory or the process of my writing. I don't tend to write a lot about that. So it was a little daunting, sort of taking the curtain away and showing the back end of things.
Was there any particular inspiration for doing that? Had you been thinking about doing it for a while?
I just kind of wanted to do so. My blog's been pretty quiet for the last year because I've had so much going on. I mean, the blog's always the first thing that falls by the wayside. And I wanted to do something to promote this collection a bit more. So I thought sort of I love, as much as I don't often talk about my own process and backstories to stories, I love reading like story notes and afterwards and everything like that, and the little things. I really love that. I love seeing behind the curtain. So I thought I might as well give it a go and see how it turns out. And it was kind of fun. It was kind of fun going back and sort of doing a forensic examination through old emails and things to see the order things happened and how long it took me to write some things, which was a little, really? I started that 6 years ago? But yeah, I don't exactly know why I thought of it, except it's something I always like reading myself, and thought, well, that might be interesting to other people as well.
During the launch, one of the things you were talking about was that it's quite a massive undertaking, the 12 Planets collection.
Yeah.
And some of the names that have been involved. So do you think that that's something that's never been done before?
Well, I can't say never, but to my knowledge, that quite focused. I mean, I know the original plan with Elisa was to have it over 12 months and one collection a month. And in retrospect, that was probably way too ambitious, especially with not having the work in advance, because things come up in writers' lives. I know she wanted the collections done a lot quicker than they have been, but, you know, things come up in lives and things get delayed and derailed and hopefully brought back on track. So, yeah, it was a huge project, and it hasn't come out in terms of the timetable that was originally planned, but the 12 volumes will come out, I think, by the end of this year. And, yeah, I can't certainly think of another project like that. Doesn't mean there isn't one, but, yeah, certainly not that I know of in recent years, with that really targeted, a very targeted approach to the authors that were chosen for the project and the rationale behind it.
Well, it's certainly become a who's who of Aussie spec fic, and I think hopefully introduced people to some of the writers who deserved the amount of credit they're now getting, which is wonderful. So for you to be part of it, what did that mean to you?
It was really exciting because I got an invitation to submit along with, I'm sure, a whole bunch of other people. Yeah, Elisa didn't just tap people on the shoulder and say, I want you to do a collection. It was a submission process. And from the first email that I got, it was like, yes, this is going to be something that's really important, and I really need to be a part of it. And I didn't at the time have a full collection of four pieces, but I did have three. So I sent them off hoping that would be enough. Not knowing, of course, that most of the other people she'd also accept didn't have full collections either. I thought, I must be the only one, but I promise I'll get you the fourth story, which I did eventually. So, yeah, it was great that she emailed back and said, well, I've read the three you've sent and I love them, and yes, I'd like you to be one of the 12. It was great. And I'm still really proud to be a part of it, even more so, actually, than when I was accepted. It was really exciting to be accepted, and now I'm just really proud of it, because the body of work that's come out through the 12 Planets series, I think almost there'd be very few of the collections that have come out that haven't been nominated, haven't had at least one story from them nominated for an award somewhere. It's just, yeah, an impressive body of work, and it's great to have one of the 12 volumes.
Now, I know that you said that some of the stories were pre-existing,
yep.
But when it comes to short stories, you've been, I guess, in novel mode for a little while now. Was it hard to get back on the short story horse?
Not really. I think short, and when I say short stories, I'm kind of looking at under 20,000 words. It's been many years since I've been able to write a short story, sort of the 3,000 to 4,000 words. That's a very difficult length for me now. My most comfortable word length would be around about the 10, give or take. And I think that's my natural sort of size that I write to. It's a really good size. You can fit most of what you want to say about something in that size. You don't have to find extra subplots to put in to not to pad out. I'm not saying you necessarily pad out novels, but you often need to bring three or four ideas together and entwine them to make something that you can write up to 120,000 words. That said, the novella that I just wrote there, The Home for Broken Dolls, it was an immense struggle to keep that under the 20,000 words. It really couldn't be more than that. And that's actually a novel, I realised, about halfway through. Whether I'll ever write that novel, because I'm not sure, a novel about psychotic sex dolls, it's incredibly commercial. I don't know. But, yeah, that was a story that, yeah, really, it needed more length. I ended up having to cut out one-third of the original tripartite arc I'd had in mind. And I had to cut out one-third, which means I had to find a new ending. Because without having the three things that I wanted to bring together, I that ending was crippled, so I needed to find a new one. Which I did, and it's fine. So I don't know. I may write a novel one day. But, yeah, that was hard. That was hard. And that may be an effect of having written a few novels now. But, yeah, still I think most of the ideas I get that I'm really passionate about bringing into a story, because I have heaps and heaps of ideas and almost, you know, so many will never get written. But the ones that I care enough about to actually want to write into a story, they're not usually novel length. Yeah, so I think that it's more natural for me to write sort of under 20,000 words than to get a really massive, complex idea that requires that much greater word length. I'm not, I don't tend to world build a lot. I don't have to spend a lot of words establishing a world that's not ours or any of that. So that's not needed. So there's a, you know, you get to take a lot of shortcuts when you're setting stories here and now, as it were.
Do you find, once you get beyond the short story, once you get into the novelettes and novellas, is that a hard sell to publishers? Obviously, the 12 Planets was built around that idea, but
yeah.
One in other markets, do you find that it's difficult to sell those? Is that like sort of not long enough and for one market and too long for other markets?
It has been. Bearing in mind, I haven't written a story at that length that hasn't been pre-sold for a few years, because I've been working on Perfections, the novel, and this 12 Planets collection was pre-sold, and I knew I had the words to work with there. But I guess maybe 5-ish years ago would have been the last time I was trying to market a longish novella, which, by the way, I couldn't sell because of length, and it has ended up in 12 Planets, which is what Amanda wants. But yeah, it was hard because most of the markets sort of go for 7.5 or 5 and under. The markets that are out there for novella-length stories are few and far between. which means, I guess, the competition is higher to get into those spots that are there. That said, there's a lot of talk now that novellas are becoming more and more popular with digital publishers and ebooks. There's the whole Kindle Singles program that they have, which focuses on long stories and novellas. Yeah, and the thinking seems to be that a novella is really good. It's like a bite-sized novel. It's something you can get into. You get a significant amount of story. It's not just 2,000 words and you're done. But it's not something you need to devote a week to or more to read. So maybe the market has changed, but I haven't needed to seek that out yet, although I guess I will now start, now that all my contracts are finished with. And as I'm still writing, I will need to find homes for the things I write. So it'll be interesting to see if indeed what I've been hearing is correct and the market for novella-length works is opening up. It makes a lot of sense to me, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen.
It's interesting you mentioned the electronic publishing, how that's changed things. Now, Perfections, you made the decision to go with Zoom, which was an electronic-only imprint.
Yep.
Now, how did you find that experience?
To be honest, from the whole process through commissioning and copy editing covers, all of that was no different to print publishing. It was the same level of care and detail that I'd had with my previous novel, which was put out through Picador as a print novel. So none of that was, including the timeline. It took about the same time to bring it to publication, which I had thought would be a little bit quicker. So from that point, which is really my side of things, it was really no different, except that there were no physical books, so they didn't get a box of books at the end as contributor copies. And we didn't really have a launch, because it's difficult to have a launch without something for people to take away from the launch and have signed and all of that stuff. So we didn't really have a launch for the books. And yeah, so that was a little different. But in terms of the pre-publication process, it was exactly the same. That's not necessarily always the case with digital publishing, but with Zoom it was. They have quite a high standard of editing processes and cover design and all of that. So I was very happy.
Now, Perfections has been extremely successful. It won an Aurealis, the Australian Shadows Award. It was nominated for a DITMAR, it took a hell of a book to beat it.
Yes.
Did you have any concerns that being an electronic-only book, that it was going to be received differently by your audience?
Yeah, well, I didn't think there would be... I'd hoped there wouldn't be any difference in reception on a critical level whereby you... Because you submit your work for the Australian Shadows Award and for the Aurealis Award and certain other awards, and those works are put in front of a jury who read them all, no matter which format they come in, that they're just reading the books. And that really, there should be no difference between whether they're reading a digital book or a paper book. And indeed, having served on juries, you often get even paper books in digital form because it's just easier. So I wasn't concerned that there's a difference there, but the concern was and remains that how well it's being found by readers who might be going to bookstores and it's not there and so on. So that's the big difference. And I still think that physical books have much more of an edge, just distribution-wise, and being found by readers. And also, physical books get their second life out in secondhand bookstores, in remaindered bookstores, and all of that. The digital books won't get to a certain extent. On the other hand, I guess digital books can be kind of around forever if the publisher keeps them online long enough. But yeah, that's the challenge. The challenge is getting readers who aren't, sitting on awards juries and reviewing and getting the things put in front of them and told, hey, read this. Yeah, just readers finding the books. And that's something that no one has a magical answer for, unfortunately. I wish there was.
So you're not just the cutting edge of technology with publishing, but you're also involved with the Writer and the Critic podcast,
yep.
Which is gaining some international recognition as well as local recognition.
Yeah, nice.
What was the inspiration behind starting that?
That was Ian. Ian was badgering me for about a year to start this thing called a podcast, because he'd started listening to a few and I didn't really want to do it. I wasn't that interested. I don't like the sound of my voice recorded. And it was like, what are we going to do? Like, who would listen to two people just talking about stuff? It's ridiculous. But yeah, he finally sort of badgered me enough. And by the time I said yes, Galactic Suburbia was running, and Cood Street, which I listened to, and they're really fun. And we had, I think, I wouldn't be so great doing a podcast like Galactic Suburbia or Cood Street, where you are just, you're talking about things, you know, that has happened in the news, things that you've, you know, like an overview type thing, or general chat and general commentary. But because what Ian wanted to do was a very focused podcast where we recommend a book to each other and critically examine them in depth, that's something that really interested me. Also because I no longer had the time to review myself in at the length that I like to. There's the amount of things that we say in our podcast and the amount of time we take to do it would take me days to actually write down as an essay. And I haven't had the time for years to do that. So having that outlet on the podcast to really examine a book and why you like it and what the author's doing with the book and why, you know, what the themes are and why it's important or not important or why you don't like it, it's really great. Sometimes it's a little taxing finding the books, but most of the time I really appreciate that outlet to talk critically about books that I otherwise would not find the time and space to do.
So are you surprised by the fact that it's has taken off? Did you ever see that it was going to be something that people would be listening to overseas, or did you see it more as a local podcast?
I don't know that I thought anybody would really listen to it. It's not because it's not a fun podcast. I mean, Galactic Suburbia, for example, is a fun podcast. I think writing the critic, it's not as fun. You know, we're essentially doing critical review. It's I mean, we joke and there are funny moments and stuff, but it's not something, I guess, you. It's not as entertaining as say This American Life or Galactic Suburbia or Radiolab, where, you know, the telling stories and talking about stuff, it's a lot more immediate. You can just sit there and listen. And if you haven't read the books we're talking about, I'm not. Apparently, a lot of people listen to it not having read the books and not planning to read the books. I'm not sure why. I like it though.
Is there a tension though? I mean, the writing community is fairly close knit. Trying to do critiques and reviews of books by people you know, is that ever a concern for you?
It was at the beginning, and in the beginning I actually wanted to put a rule in place where we didn't review books of people we were friends with. And I was kind of adamant about it, and Ian was going, well, then what are we going to review? Because you get to, you know, if you're in this community and you, I mean, where do you draw the line? Do you do a review a book with someone you've only just tweeted with or bumped into at a convention or just, you know, conversed by their blog? Do you only review books with someone you've never had any contact with whatsoever? And then what happens if later you do become a friend of them and you've already reviewed their book and maybe you didn't like it, as has happened? But I think you just have to be able to divorce that from the book review. And we have reviewed books of friends with varying degrees of liking the book, and just people we know. And if you're an author, you have to divorce that as well. And you can't take criticism of either kind, whether it's positive or negative, to necessarily be a reflection about yourself. And I think on the podcast we did here at Continuum, we had Nora Jemison as our guest on the podcast, and she said a couple times that she just tells herself over and over that criticism is a form of love. And it is. I mean, her point is that love, I mean, that's a word with a lot of connotations, but the point is even people enraging about a book and talking about how much they don't like it, they're still engaged with that book. The worst thing is if someone reads a book or watches a movie and just goes, huh, and never ever mentions it to anyone ever because they just don't care. So, yeah, it's a balancing act, but you kind of have to do it. And you kind of forget. You just forget when you're talking about the book that you're talking about, actually, this is my friend's book, or not that we've done that many of really close friends, but yeah. You have to just forget about it and then listen back to it later and think, maybe they shouldn't listen to this episode.
Speaking of community, you've recently moved from Melbourne to Ballarat.
Yep.
I don't know whether you've been there long enough to have noticed any difference, but how do you find being away from the community you've been part of for a number of years?
At the moment, I don't think we've really felt much difference. It's only been 5 months. We haven't had time to settle into Ballarat properly and really get to know the place. We've joined the Ballarat Writers Centre there, but haven't actually been to visit yet. We will. We intend to soon. We've just been so busy. But there hasn't been a lot of difference because certainly with the first half of this year, we still had a lot of things that we planned. Because it was kind of sudden, the whole house buying thing. It wasn't something we'd been planning for years. And we found a house a lot quicker than we thought, and like, bang, now we're moving. So we had actually a lot of stuff still planned and booked and organised. So we've been back to Melbourne a lot and to other cons in other states a lot. So it doesn't feel like we've actually seen less of people than we would have if we were still living in Melbourne. Whether that changes over the years, I'm not sure, but Ballarat's only 90 minutes out of Melbourne. It's not, we haven't moved into, you know, the centre of Australia and, you know, really isolated. Yeah, I don't know, it'll be interesting. But the other thing is that a lot of the people I keep in touch, they're not in Melbourne anyway, they're people who are all over Australia, they're overseas, and you keep in touch via Twitter and Facebook and email and all of that, and then you catch up intermittently at conventions you all happen to be at. So that's not going to change. We still intend to go to conventions and to stay on the internet. So yeah, there might be small changes, but overall I don't think there'll be much of an isolation. Plus, you know, we have a guest bedroom, so people can come and stay. Not everyone.
I was about to say, listeners, please don't take that as
not a general invitation.
Now, I don't want to make you blush or anything, but obviously you're one of the, you know, foremost horror writers in Australia now. You've won pretty much every award that you can win in Australia. You've written some of the best horror novels of the past couple of years. You've been involved in the 12 Planets. So I guess, is there anything left that you're in Australia that you want to achieve, and what's next for Kirsten McDermott?
There's a lot I still want to do. I guess if you're looking at, I don't know, notches on the bedpost or something, that there isn't a lot of those left, I guess, boxes to tick sort of thing. But I mean, I don't really isolate Australia from everywhere else, and there's still a lot I want to do. That said, the next project I'm working on is completely different to anything I've done. It's not horror at all. It's more, it's science fiction, but in the way that The Time Traveller's Wife is science fiction. Yeah, which is challenging. That means I'm not going to get to use most of my box of tricks that I've worked up over the first, you know, 20 years of my writing. Yeah, all of the scary, spooky, creepy stuff. I don't get to use that because this is a different type of a book, but it's an idea I've had for a couple of years and it's one I'm really, really keen to write. So it will be interesting to see what happens if I get that done and it gets published and what people think of it. I think I'll always be writing horror fiction, dark fantasy, gothic, whatever you want to call it. It's a type of literature that's always speaks very closely to me. So it's not something I see myself ever drifting permanently away from, but I read incredibly widely. And yeah, I've had ideas that I'd like to explore that definitely aren't contained within the horror genre. So it'll be interesting. It's as I said, it's daunting, but I'm also finding it really exciting to be finding new ways to tell stories that aren't necessarily, you know, falling back on the devices and the skills that I've sort of honed up till now. So yeah, it'll be fun.
So, looking back, are there any authors that you would point out as being influences on your work?
Oh, yeah, heaps. I guess the more explicit ones... I mean, two of my very favourite authors for many, many years are Stephen King and Caitlin Kiernan. And I think if you look at various stages of my work, I'm not sure you could see much Stephen King, but I think in some of my early work you could definitely see a lot of stylistic influences from Caitlin Kiernan. And, yeah, Kathy Koja is another author who I adore. I think she's amazing. Poppy Bright's work was very influential. Clive Barker back in the day. Nowadays, I would love to be able to crack the code of how Rob Sherman writes stuff. And another author I've just discovered, Helen Marshall, who writes the same sort of quasi-whimsical kind of tone to her work, but her work's quite visceral and there's a physicality to her work that's quite different to most of Rob Sherman's work, and yet they feel very close in terms of their voice and their style, which is a wonderful, accessible storytelling voice, and it's beautiful, and I'd love to experiment with that kind of a voice a little, but I haven't quite cracked that yet. So yeah, I don't know, it's almost everything. When I think when you're a writer, it kind of spoils reading for you a little bit, because half of your brain is almost always, as much as you might be enjoying something, half of your brain is also trying to decode how that's been done, and you know, oh, that's so clever how they've done that, and even when you're disliking something, you're still often working out why is it that you're not liking it, what is wrong with the prose, what is wrong with the story. So, you know, it can sometimes ruin reading, but it also heightens it. You have a different appreciation for it. So, yeah, it's almost like everything you read is sort of threads in there. And I guess you try to take stuff on board without necessarily writing pastiches or really blatant copies. You're just trying to find your own way to do things that you like in other writers, which can be difficult. Yeah.
So are you saying that you read widely? Are there any newer authors or up-and-coming ones or ones that you've recently discovered you wanted to recommend to the listeners?
Helen Marshall, definitely, as I said. Her collection, which is through Cheezine Publications, Hairside, Fleshside, really, really good. Really, really good work. Megan Abbott is a crime writer who Ian actually recommended one of her books for our podcast last year, and I've since devoured a few of them. And she's fantastic. She writes sort of period, sort of hard-boiled-ish crime stories, but with an emphasis on tracking the stories of women in that same world. And the voices that she's able to use is just fantastic. And her latest book, which I haven't read, but I'm it's going to be read very soon, is actually a bit of a departure from that. It's still sort of a crime mystery-ish novel, but it's set in contemporary America, and it's about cheerleaders. And it sounds wonderful. I heard her reading the first chapter of it at the Adelaide Writers' Week a couple of years ago, and it... Yeah, I'm so looking forward to reading that book. So she's great. She's really, really great and unexpected. And that's actually another good thing about doing the podcast, because I probably would never have found Megan Abbott, but Ian brought the book in and said, here's what I'm recommending. It's like, really? So yes, Megan Abbott, fantastic voice. I think also what Lisa Hannett and Angela Slater are doing with their short fiction is amazing, and they're both working on novels, and I'm really keen to see their novels when they're done. Work that interests me is often a lot to do with language as much as it is to do with story, and I think the writers who have an emphasis on language are always going to be... I'm going to feel a lot more engaged with them than just a writer who tells a really good story but whose language is not as... I can't really think of a word, because it's not that it's not as competent or anything like that. It's just not as lyrical or as sometimes baroque which isn't to say that writing really clean, transparent prose isn't an incredible skill to have. It's just it's not something that I am drawn to as much. I really like language that plays with itself and goes out of its way to point out that this is a story that's being told rather than something that tries to be transparent, that doesn't pull it as much to me. So, yeah, that would be some that I'm recommending.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure that all the listeners will enjoy hearing those recommendations, but as well as the rest of the interview. So, yeah, that's about it for today. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.